Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. Today we arrive at the last of the lectures. We come bang up against the present and the future of NATO history. So this will be it until the 70th anniversary at least. Let's hope there is one. But I would like to start by thanking you, particularly those of you who were here since the very beginning. To paraphrase Dean Acheson, you were present at the creation. I'm grateful for your support, for your interest. Solidarity is a fine NATO principle. And moreover, if you've been here since the beginning, you've demonstrated the fundamental quality of any NATO member, the capacity to listen to somebody talking interminably without falling asleep, or at least pretending not to fall asleep. So I've greatly appreciated you as an audience and your questions and interest. Today, we reached the final turning point of the 1990s, which, of course, came during the war in the former Yugoslavia. I've tried to design this series, as you recall, around turning points, the things that move NATO into a different direction. We saw that, just to recap, in the 1940s, it was the decision of the United States to go from isolationism to European engagement. We saw in the 50s it was the decision to convert NATO from a treaty into a real alliance, an organization, with a Secretary General, with a staff, with people like me and some of you, and with its own military structures. We saw then in the 60s that we moved from a defense-based strategy to a detente-based strategy. And we developed NATO's political role for the first time. In the 70s, we went from being a nuclear moderniser to a nuclear disarmer and started negotiations with our adversaries, as they then were for the first time. Then in the 80s, just a couple of days ago, we saw how we went from keeping the Warsaw Pact out to bringing the Warsaw Pact in. The end of the Cold War and NATO's new role, no longer to maintain a division of Europe, but to overcome it. Today we arrive at a moment when NATO, in many cases, started to be NATO for the first time, when for the first time we used our military forces to actually resolve a conflict, instead of going, or instead of avoiding conflict, which is what we'd managed to do for the first half century of our existence. We went from an organisation that recognised that in certain circumstances, to uphold its credibility, it had to be ready to engage in conflicts and to fight conflicts and, if necessary, to win them. So it was truly the crossing of a Rubicon, from waiting to be attacked to a situation where we sent for the first time NATO forces outside the treaty area to try to resolve the problems of others in other countries. Now, let me begin with an anecdote. It's the 28th of February, 1994. I've just arrived at the office. I'm the NATO spokesman. The telephone rings. I pick it up and I recognise the husky German voice of Manfred Werner, the NATO Secretary General, calling me from a hospital bed in the Klinikum in Aachen, Germany, where he had gone to be treated from the cancer which eventually killed him in August of 1994. He was in a very excited state. I said, "Secretary General, what is it?" He said, "Have you seen the news?" "Yes, I have." I came into the office. The news of that day was that for the first time ever, NATO had fired a shot. In fact, four shots. NATO aircraft implementing a no-fly zone over Bosnia had shot down four Bosnian Serb aircraft, which had violated that UN-sponsored no-fly zone. "Secretary General, you're in hospital. Why should you be worried about this? You get yourself better." No. This is a significant moment. Werner had been calling for years for NATO to get tough, particularly with the Bosnian Serbs, not to sit on the sidelines as terrible atrocities, rapes, war crimes were committed, to show that NATO stood on the European continent for democratic values. He was a passionate humanitarian interventionist, even before the responsibility to protect and the right of humanitarian intervention became standard parts of the international community. He felt passionately that if we allowed ethnic cleansing, the carve-up of states, the transfer of populations to go unpunished in the Balkans, it would rapidly bring down the party atmosphere on the streets of Berlin that this, the end of the Cold War, marked the outbreak of universal peace in Europe and that we could all forget about conflict for the rest of our lives. And although, yes, NATO's first shot was a fairly modest affair, four Bosnian Serb trainer aircraft being down, for him, this represented that precise moment when the Allies would go from how little they could do in Bosnia to deciding how much they needed to do to bring about the end of the conflict. So he asked me to get a camera team together quickly, to approach CNN, the BBC, many of the other networks. We borrowed his two Mercedes. We went at 200 kilometres down the Autobahn to the Klinikum. And we found a Manfred Werner, who had lost a lot of weight, who was not looking in particularly good condition, quite frankly. And we spent most of the morning converting his hospital room into a TV studio. We took out the bed, we took the drip feeds out of his neck. He had a great deal of makeup. We put him in a suit and so on. And then he gave his interview and responded to the fact that NATO had finally done what he'd been calling on the alliance to do, to show that it was not a paper tiger, that it would uphold UN resolutions and uphold our values. And that was, in his life, a great moment. But it was also really the moment when the NATO of today, the NATO of Afghanistan, the NATO that operates on a global basis, the NATO that confronts 21st century challenges, was born. Of course, the first few years of the Bosnian War had been a deeply frustrating time for the alliance. When the war broke out, initially in Croatia, Slovenia for a short period, in 1991, a Luxembourg foreign minister at the time proclaimed that this was the hour of Europe, not the hour of the United States. Still with the hangover of the great party of the end of communism on the streets of Prague or of Berlin or of Warsaw, we genuinely believed that henceforth all communists would be Democrats, as many of them tried to be in Central and Eastern Europe. They would all want to draw closer to the European Union and to NATO. They would all want economic assistance. They could all be treated like gentlemen who are rational individuals who are prepared to broker rational solutions. We totally underestimated the way in which communism transmogrified into nationalism in the former Yugoslavia. So NATO stood on the sidelines as the EU troika made repeated visits to see Tudjman in Croatia and Milosevic in Belgrade, to offer trade agreements, to offer a European enlargement perspective to that country, to appeal for moderation, all in the belief that the kind of spirit of intelligent compromise that works inside the European Union would be effective in working between the European Union and other states. The Common European Foreign and Security Policy was not at that time born, and the European Union had no military force to offer. But NATO was also on the sidelines. We were on the sidelines because essentially we had profound political differences in our analysis of the fall of Yugoslavia. For some, like Germany, it represented a kind of late 20th century equivalent of Woodrow Wilson's principle of self-determination, that as Germany had exercised self-determination in uniting itself, so the same principle should allow Croatia, Slovenia, Bosnia to pull apart from the old Yugoslavia. The Americans, by contrast, were deeply worried about the collapse of Yugoslavia. Jim Baker, the Secretary of State, went to Belgrade in June 1991 and pronounced, "We don't have a dog in this fight." In other words, we don't have a position in this conflict. And Milosevic certainly took that as a signal that the United States, preoccupied with the impending collapse of the Soviet Union, would not be prepared to sanction him if he used force to keep the Yugoslav Union together. The British, the French, who had had Yugoslavia as an ally in the First World War and the Second World War, shared similar sentiments. To allow borders to be changed, apart from German unification, which was a special event, might send a bad signal to other nationalist disputes between Hungarians and Romanians in Transylvania, between Czechs and Slovaks, would send a bad signal elsewhere. Bush President Bush, father of George W., just to be certain, President H.W. Bush, had just been in Ukraine giving his famous Chicken Kiev speech, which I mentioned in my last lecture, very much to discourage nationalism. And therefore, the Allies divided in what they wanted to do in Yugoslavia, stayed very much on the sidelines as the war broke out. Indeed, there was almost a sense that in a Europe which was celebrating the end of history and the resurgence of democratic values, military force was almost like a 19th century concept to be used, and it wouldn't be too long before eventually the Yugoslavs, who were, after all, intelligent people who had had the most developed form of socialism in the old days of the communist bloc, who were highly educated. It would only be a few days before they came to their senses and put a stop to it all. Why did Yugoslavia collapse? Well, when I was a student many years ago, many years ago, the typical exam question, if you were doing a degree in international relations, is that, you know, when the communist bloc eventually dissolves, which country is going to have the easiest transition from communism to capitalism, which one famous Polish commentator once described as, in terms of, it's easy to turn an aquarium into fish soup, but it's much harder to turn fish soup back into an aquarium. And, of course, as the Americans say, this was a no-brainer. It was obviously going to be Yugoslavia, the country with devolved republics with a great degree of autonomy, the country of worker self-management, the country where millions of Germans and Italians and Brits went every year to sun themselves on the beaches of Dubrovnik, the country which had escaped the clutches of Stalin in 1948 and had split off in the early 1950s from the Warsaw Pact even before it had been fully formed. And the paradox is that this country, which seemed to have the most chance to make the transition, is the one that made the biggest mess of it and descended into mass violence, so that 2 years later, by 1993, nearly 300,000 of its inhabitants had been killed, and 40% of the population, 2.5 million people in particular, had been made refugees. 40% of the population in all, nearly 8 million people, had been internally displaced. Well, I'm not here today and I don't have time to analyse all the reasons why Yugoslavia collapsed, but certainly the fact is that after the Cold War, the Yugoslav leadership, knowing that communism was no longer a legitimising factor and not being able to define their objective as liberation from an external occupier, the Soviet Union, to keep themselves in power, manipulated the nationalist theme. And once it started, it quickly became an action-reaction cycle, inducing an atmosphere almost of mass paranoia, where to kill was the best way to avoid being killed oneself. As the Yugoslav conflict became more and more bloody and terrible and protracted, as it spread to Bosnia in 1992 in the wake of Bosnia following Croatia and Slovenia and declaring independence, the NATO allies basically split into two groups. And this also made it difficult. On the one hand, there were the pessimists who sort of recalled European history, the Balkans powder keg, who recalled the Marquis de Salaberry, the French writer who had called the Balkans the unpolished extremities of Europe, and believed that this was rather like a conflict out of Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, two feuding communities, the Montagues and the Capulets, who hated each other, always had done, would never get on, and this was a civil war, basically, where the international community could never make peace until the parties were exhausted and decided to make peace themselves. Even the American Secretary of State at the time, Lawrence Eagleburger, said in September 92, until the Bosnian Serbs and Croats decide to stop killing each other, there is nothing the outside world can do. After all, this country was a country, Yugoslavia, with six republics, five nations, four languages, three religions, and two alphabets, all held together by one party, the League of Yugoslav Communists. Churchill famously declared that the Balkans produce more history than they can consume. Everybody remembers Bismarck and his famous phrase about the Balkans not being worth the bones of a Pomeranian grenadier. It was, as Warren Christopher, the American Secretary of State, who replaced Eagleburger, once famously declared, a problem from hell. Very complicated, ancestral hatreds. What could the international community do by intervening that would make it any better? Far better to wait to see who would be the winner, who would be the loser, and then make peace. But there was another camp, the optimists. Interestingly, largely on the left wing of European politics, who believed passionately that what had happened was not a civil war at all, but a war of international aggression, largely coming out of Belgrade, which would set a bad precedent, border changes, loss of territorial integrity, ethnic cleansing, the use of violence to solve problems, and that the international community had the power, if it only was prepared to use even limited force, to sort this out. Yugoslavia was the big testing ground for people like Bernard Kouchner and Médecins Sans Frontières, Joschka Fischer in Germany, Gareth Evans, the Australian foreign minister, which finally realised the notion of not just the right, but indeed the duty of a humanitarian intervention. And indeed, in the 1990s, particularly in the wake of the American air campaign against Iraq in Kuwait, in the first Gulf War, there was a great belief that we could have war without tears, that military technology, the revolution of military affairs, had advanced in such a way that we really could employ decisive force in a way which would spare our own lives, spare the civilian population, but which would be decisive enough to send a message to Milosevic and to the others that they had to stop fighting. But unfortunately, these two camps, the pessimists and the optimists, largely cancelled each other out. NATO got involved in a series of efforts to assist the United Nations, beginning in 1991 with a naval embargo in the Adriatic, then a no-fly zone over Bosnia. Then in 1993, at a meeting in Athens, we agreed on close air support, the idea of using NATO air power to intervene to protect the UN forces, UNPROFOR, that had been deployed in the theatre if they were attacked and if they called on NATO's assistance. But here was the rub. NATO had subcontracted the decision on whether to use NATO force to another organisation, the UN, under the so-called dual key system. We could not use force unless NATO decided and simultaneously the UN decided. The problem was twofold. A, it was highly unlikely that the two organisations would have a sufficiently common analysis to decide at the same time to use force. When we wanted to, they didn't want to, and vice versa. Secondly, the UN believed that the threat of force without actually using it would be enough to moderate the behaviour of the belligerents. The Serbs, of course, are not silly. Naturally, no. They quickly recognised that this was an empty threat because there would never be an intention to use it. The problem was that if you bombed from the air, immediately the UN forces, many of which came from NATO countries, would be seized, held hostage. They might be killed in retaliation. In other words, it was not the Serbs that contradicted our policy. We contradicted it ourselves. We became a paper tiger. I have still in my office, which reminds me every day about NATO's credibility, a cartoon. And it comes from the Boston Globe in 1994. And it shows two naked people on a bed, a man and a woman, husband and wife. And clearly things have not gone as well as they should have. And the wife has this very indulgent smile to her husband with a look of sorrow in a big bubble and says, "Don't worry, honey. It even happened to NATO." In other words, we were doing the one thing that a serious security organisation must never do, which is to use its most formidable asset in the most nugatory, ineffective way. As William Safire of the New York Times put it, it's either Bosnia alive or NATO dead. Eventually, the story has a happier ending. we finally did take decisive action. Admittedly, it was only after we had been shamed into doing it, after the massacre in Srebrenica in July 1995, when the Bosnian Serbs, as everybody knows, took the town and murdered 8,000 of Muslim, essentially Muslim, Bosnian Muslim men and boys. This also had the advantage of obliging the UN to withdraw back to Sarajevo, which allowed us then to use decisive military force. Having sat in so many NATO meetings at the time, listening to commanders saying that it would take 500,000 troops to sort out Yugoslavia, because after all, Hitler, during the Second World War, so it was said, had never managed to subjugate Yugoslavia, even though he put 40 divisions there. Totally wrong. The Germans never had more than three divisions in Yugoslavia throughout the Second World War. But there was this myth that the Yugoslavs had managed to hold even the greatest armies at bay, and therefore we would need mobilisation in NATO member states if we were to be successful. And that air power could never succeed in a country like Yugoslavia because of the fog and the terrain and so on. No. When we finally used force during a nine-day air campaign in September 1995, a couple of weeks later, we had the Dayton Peace Agreement. I'm not arguing that NATO uniquely was responsible for this outcome. The Americans had worked hard in bringing the Croats and the Bosnian Muslims, the Bosniaks, closer together, which then put the Serbs at a disadvantage. That's true. But it would not have been done without the NATO air campaign. So the first conclusion is, I'm not pretending that force works in every circumstances, but if you are at least have the courage to use it decisively, it does increase your chance of being successful. When we got to Kosovo a few years later, although I'm not going to argue that that was a perfect campaign either, at least we learned the lessons. We stopped making empty threats. There have been too many empty threats during the Bosnian years. We remembered the dictum of Frederick the Great of Prussia, that diplomacy without arms is like music without instruments. The use of force was much more closely tied to the international negotiating strategy of people like Dick Holbrooke and others, and the Rambouillet Peace Conference that tried to settle the problem of Kosovo. There was much more unity in the alliance, too, in the willingness to actually use force if the deadlines ran out, and we managed to convince Milosevic. Unlike the Bosnian years, when nobody from NATO ever went to talk to Milosevic or Tudjman or the belligerents during the war, we sent plenty of people to Belgrade to talk with Milosevic to make it clear to him that we were serious. And finally, we did prepare in Kosovo a ground option which was ready to go in if necessary. And, of course, to be the peace force, which is still there today, KFOR, when the air campaign was ultimately successful. Admittedly, it was not a very comfortable situation for me as the NATO spokesman at the time to always have to defend. We had no UN mandate. People went around saying that it may not be legal, but it's legitimate. But I will be the first one to accept that public opinion did not always understand that fine distinction. We overestimated in Kosovo the use of air power. We underestimated in Bosnia the use of air power, and then paradoxically we overestimated it in Kosovo. Even today I find it difficult to answer the question, Jamie, how comes you use thousands of laser-guided missiles and only destroyed 14 Serb tanks? We worry too much about our own strategy and too little about the strategy of Milosevic, our adversary, particularly in not foreseeing the countermeasures that he took, like human shields or mixing the military with the civilian population, forcing out the refugees and causing that humanitarian disaster. And it would have been helpful if we'd prepared a ground option earlier to convince Milosevic that we would be ready to employ that. But still, nonetheless, we came out of the Balkans having had a hard learning experience. As if I may quote Winston Churchill again, he once said about the Americans that they always do the right thing having exhausted all of the alternatives. We were the same. We eventually did the right thing in the Balkans, but having exhausted lots of alternatives and having wasted a great deal of time. I still believe today that those 300,000 Yugoslavs, many of them would be alive had we intervened immediately, that the shelling of Dubrovnik started in 1991 and not waited until 95, 4 years later, to use force. What were the lessons? Well, certainly that you cannot mix peacekeeping on the ground with peace enforcement in the air. You can't have the decision on the use of force split between different organisations with different objectives. You've got to have a common analysis in the alliance, and you can't have the Americans doing one thing and the Europeans doing something totally different. As a famous NATO supreme commander said, it's either in together and it's out together, or it's one team and one mission. Exactly. Just like you cannot have NATO as the Europeans doing things without the Americans, so you cannot have NATO as the Americans doing things without the Europeans. But we also learned the lesson that fighting is the easy part. The conflict is the easy part. The thing that NATO is best at doing, which is winning conflicts, if necessary, with its military force, is the easy part. And the thing that then NATO gets called upon to do, which is to implement the peace on the ground, is the hardest part. What we're finding is that the conflict part is getting smaller and smaller and smaller, and the implementation part is getting longer and harder, Afghanistan being the case in point. That said, ladies and gentlemen, if NATO was good for the Balkans were as good, if not better, for NATO. The intervention in Yugoslavia, although it had been a difficult, hesitant affair, a very disputatious affair. People often refer to arguments in the alliance over Iraq in 2003, but I can assure you that in 1994, the row was just as hard here over policy towards Bosnia. I remember even Warren Christopher, the American Secretary of State, coming here to a meeting in 94 saying, okay, we're going to change our strategy because NATO is more important to us than Bosnia. It was very difficult, finally, for countries to give up very passionate policies vis-a-vis the Balkan conflict in the name of maintaining NATO solidarity. But still, we'd got through it in a way that had brought about a massive transformation of the alliance, which we are still living with today. The first aspect, is the shift to out of area. Dick Lugar, the American senator, said it's either out of area or out of business. By 1995, we were definitely out of area and in business. Secondly, we'd gone from a Cold War scenario of predicated on the massive use of force, you know, massive retaliation, nuclear war, to one in which we had to learn to use force in very multiple, very precise ways, and even simultaneously. For example, in Yugoslavia, we had a naval embargo, a no-fly zone, close air protection of the UN, an air campaign, a peace implementation force, managing airspace, managing airports, disarming the local militias and creating a zone of separation, training the Bosnian army and forming it, supervising elections, taking out mines, building the infrastructure, guarding war crime sites, need I go on. In other words, the military force has to be used now in a variety of different ways to be successful. We also learned something else, which is haunting us today in Afghanistan, that in the Cold War, NATO was able to achieve its objectives with its own members. We didn't need anybody else. As long as the Allies could find a common denominator and acted, that was enough. Now, for the first time in Bosnia, we learned that we could go in by ourselves, but we could not come back out by ourselves. The comprehensive approach, although we didn't use that title then, was born in Bosnia. In other words, you have to get the World Bank to invest. You need the EU to work on governance. You need the UN to organise elections. And even our partners, particularly those partners in the region like Albania, former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, have had an absolutely vital role to play in basing our troops, in basing our aircraft, and in showing solidarity with that particular effort. In other words, NATO suddenly realised that it would be a sort of necessary condition of success But that would be by itself insufficient. You are only as good as your ability to work with others. It's not enough any longer simply to leverage your own efforts. You've got to be able to persuade others to work with you and provide serious efforts as well. Next thing we learned was that burden sharing would be a big issue for NATO. In those days, it was still easy. We went through 9 years in Bosnia, and we've been in Kosovo this year for 10 years without losing a single fatality to combat. We lost people to traffic accidents and military training accidents, but never was anybody killed in a hostile action in all those years. But what became apparent once the Bosnian conflict started was that although deterrence in the Cold War protection could be done by just one ally all by himself, the United States, that the new NATO role in conflict resolution and peacekeeping required the contribution of every ally. Nobody could stand on the sidelines. In other words, membership, which had been a largely passive affair, I allow myself to be protected, became suddenly a very active affair where you had to also take risks and make contributions and spend money and, if necessary, accept casualties. Suddenly, NATO membership became a performance-based phenomenon. I think it was a bit of a shock at the time to the countries that joined NATO in 1999, who had joined for protection, who had joined to be part of the Euro-Atlantic community, and 10 days after joining, I'm talking about Hungary, Poland and the Czech Republic, suddenly found that they had to go to Kosovo as their first NATO duty. I'm glad to say that they passed the test with flying colours, but it did cause some eyebrows to be raised amongst public opinion in their capitals. Finally, we learned the need for public parliamentary support. Communications, public diplomacy, strategic messaging became important. The thing we learned in Kosovo is that because NATO feels that it's doing the right thing, because we feel we have a just cause, doesn't mean to say that our public automatically accepts that. If our strategy isn't working, if the conflict becomes bloody, if we lose casualties, if nobody sees signs of progress, for example, public support can disappear very quickly indeed. And therefore, keeping the home front together is as important as keeping allied governments together. Now, we emerge, therefore, from the Balkans experience very much as a transformed organisation. There would be a significant new role for NATO, ladies and gentlemen, in the 21st century. There would be no lack of international demand for NATO's assets, whether that be in planning, in interoperability, in multinational commands, in sustaining long-term operations. But, paradoxically, this new role for NATO was guaranteed to put the alliance under almost permanent strain as a result. Deploying forces rather than just leaving them in the barracks was going to be very expensive. Would you spend on operations or would you spend on modernization? With low defense budgets, you weren't going to be able to do both. It was the end of warfare without tears. Although we lost nobody in the Balkans, the mission in Afghanistan today has cost the NATO countries, whether in ISAF or whether in Operation Enduring Freedom, 1,074 combat dead. An unprecedented experience since World War II for many allies. The third thing is that we've discovered, as I said before, that implementation is getting longer and longer and more difficult, which requires the readiness to commit assets for a very, very long period and to rotate. It's also raised the debate in NATO about whether these expeditionary missions might undermine our core function of Article 5 defence of the territory of our member states. In other words, is the threat from Afghanistan so great that it justifies the diversion of resources from homeland defence, which means that NATO must have a very clear strategic rationale for what it's doing. I personally believe that Afghanistan and the threat it poses if we allow that country to become a failed state in the grip of terrorists is on par with an Article 5 need for collective defence and solidarity. But obviously, there will be debates in NATO on this, and we need to find a way forward. making the comprehensive approach work. We felt that because it worked in the Balkans, it would automatically work in Afghanistan. It would somehow be there in the way that it was there in the Balkans, that you would arrive and you would look around and there would be a shiny new UN headquarters with a high-level international coordinator with millions of dollars in his rucksack, ready to build dams and roads and bridges and schools. The EU would immediately be there with an enormous infrastructure, the World Bank and so on. And we discovered that that was simply not the case. And reinventing the comprehensive approach in the Balkans has proved a difficult exercise. And we have learned also that military transformation is increasingly necessary as you are under more and more pressure to get more and more use and usability out of your forces. You have to abandon Cold War legacy systems, focus on enablers like helicopters and transport aircraft, find multinational solutions for funding things that you need, which nations that have those things, like helicopters, can't afford to deploy by themselves, and finding more common funding to express solidarity that those who have the assets don't always have to pay themselves all of the bill of using those assets. So the transformation of NATO to be a more global actor, on the one hand, has certainly given NATO a new rationale, new lease of life, a new justification, but inevitably has also posed perhaps greater challenges on its internal structures than it has faced before in its history, which then finally reopens the question of the level of ambition of the alliance as it looks towards its future. Is it going to be an organization which does essentially operations? In other words, it defines itself by where it happens to be with its forces. Or is it going to look at a big spectrum of challenges beyond deploying forces, like energy security or cyber attacks or terrorism or the global aspects of climate change on security? Is it going to be an organisation that does operations or which tries to contribute to the security debate about how the world is going to be structured, particularly through arms control and disarmament and non-proliferation? Is it going to be basically an organisation which consults and analyses, or an organisation which still acts first and foremost? Will it focus on Europe and Afghanistan will be the exception, or will it become increasingly global and focus on the wider world? Will the future NATO do most of its things inside Europe or outside Europe? Will it be a jack of all trades by overextending itself and master of none? Goethe, the great German writer, once said, and my German is very bad, but something like in der Begrenzung versteht sich der Meister. But anyway, in my Cockney English, I would say that the wise guy limits himself. And that may be also something that NATO has to follow. So, ladies and gentlemen, finally, as we arrive at 2009 and NATO's 60th anniversary, what have we learned from NATO's history over the previous six decades, which could be sort of pointers? I started out by quoting Friedrich von Schlegel, the German 19th century historian, who said the historian is a prophet looking backwards. And certainly, what do we see in the past which could prophesize what the future will be? I think the first thing that we've seen in our six turning points is there's no golden age. You know, we always believe nostalgically that the present is bad, the future will be even worse, and the past was somehow a marvelous time of transatlantic harmony, automatic solidarity, immediate shared analyses. If you've been awake during my lectures, you will know that that is complete nonsense. NATO has always been an organization not only portrayed as in crisis, but sometimes actually really in crisis. Maybe that's the best you can hope from having a series of democracies around the same table. There have always been big debates, bitter, passionate debates about NATO's orientation. You know, in the 40s, should it be a military or an economic structure? Who was going to join? Would it be a short-term arrangement or a long-term arrangement? It took years before those arguments were settled. We saw in the 50s, you know, where the Americans at one stage made the European defense community the sine qua non of their commitment and then dropped it. The argument about whether to bring Germany into NATO or not, whether the US strategy should be focused on Asia and on Europe, that took years to decide as well. We saw in the 60s that NATO had a near-death experience when the General de Gaulle ordered NATO to leave France in 1966 and 1967, when the small countries of NATO were increasingly frustrated that their voices weren't heard by the big. But then Pierre Hamel came along with his Hamel report and allowed us to get over that and move forward. We saw just a couple of weeks ago with the dual track decision in the 70s that, you know, NATO had thousands of demonstrators on the streets protesting, keeping NATO allies together through a difficult decision to deploy was certainly something that didn't happen by itself. We saw last time in the 80s that everything that was NATO's frame of reference, the Cold War, suddenly fell apart, and we suddenly had to reinvent ourselves in a totally different world. And we've seen today with NATO's first shot that NATO confronted for several years this extremely difficult debate about whether its main mission was simply collective defence, and leaving to others the responsibility to sort out the problems of the modern world, or whether whatever the difficulties, NATO couldn't shirk that responsibility and should do it itself. So we've seen that, you know, if that was the turbulent past, the one safe prediction to make is that the future will be equally turbulent, if not more turbulent. And therefore, what do these crisis periods tell us? Well, I would just like to point to three issues right at the very end. There are probably many more. But these are the three that have occurred to me. The first thing is what I call the paradox of relevance. We now know that the strategic vacation of the 90s was an illusion. We've gone back to the natural order of things, which is that human beings have an alarming propensity for conflict. There will always be a Milosevic or a Saddam Hussein or a Osama bin Laden to start a war. It simply moves from ideology to nationalism to ethnic identity, religion, or values. We will hope, of course, for a future free of conflict, but we're not likely to get it. So there will not be a lack of things for NATO to do. But we also know that the paradox of that is that it will be very, very difficult for NATO to come to a collective view on how to solve those particular conflicts. There will be different threat assessments. We've seen that over the last few years. Different priorities, different public opinions, different cultures in nations, different capabilities, different levels of effort. We will use communiques to invoke solidarity, burden sharing, responsibility, common values. And that is correct. But the point I want to make is that we'll need leadership. None of those things will ever get solved by the invocation of principles like solidarity alone. It's going to require firm leadership, imaginative leadership, inspired leadership to keep NATO together. In the past, we were very lucky. We had it. I've referred to a whole number of larger-than-life characters. Truman, Acheson, Bevin, Hamel, Reagan, Helmut Schmidt, Manfred Werner as Secretary General in the 1980s. We will need to have leaders of equal status in future to hold us together. We have had near-death experiences in the past over Iraq, over Bosnia. Fortunately, near death is much better than real death. I can tell you that. But we should never be complacent that because NATO survived in the past, it will somehow all by itself survive in the future without leadership. Secondly, crises are good for NATO. I've spent a great deal of my life rebutting the notion that NATO is in crisis, which is what every journalist or commentator likes to write. But as I sort of get towards the end of my NATO career, I suddenly sort of realised that maybe, you know, crises are good for NATO. That's what we do best. It often takes a crisis to get NATO to move. I remember in Bosnia, we were having endless debates about whether we could do peacekeeping for the OSCE and getting nowhere. And then the UN came and said, guys, please, implement a naval embargo. Okay, fine. Without a crisis, that sort of theological conversion would never have been made. NATO is not the EU. We're not very good at sort of designing new concepts or treaties or constitutions or having intellectual debates. We're much better at having a concrete problem put to us and then moving forward. Some French diplomats in the past have got rather frustrated with this lack of a Cartesian method. One once told me, Jamie, I know this works in principle, but could it ever work in theory? Does it matter? Does it matter? The point is that every time there's been a NATO anniversary, it's always coincided with a crisis situation. If you look back, at, for example, the 30th anniversary, Cruz and Pershing. The 40th anniversary, the collapse of communism. The 50th anniversary, the middle of the Kosovo air campaign. Just like the one in Strasbourg and Kiel in a few weeks' time will be dominated by what can we do to make sure that we don't lose in Afghanistan. Finally, the paradox of military power. I am a great believer in NATO as a forum for political consultation. Yes, I'm a great believer that we should analyse problems and work out strategies and so on. But what separates NATO from other international organisations? We have a culture of using military power. Not in an aggressive sense, obviously not. It's under democratic control. But people associate us with where our forces are. That's really what we do. That's where the rubber hits the road. That's where we make the difference. The fact that we are able to do more than simply analyse and strategise, but we can also implement results because we have those military capabilities. Now, that is important to my mind. In other words, NATO cannot afford to see that instrument devalued. We went from a period in the Cold War where it worked well. Military power procured deterrence, prevented intimidation, prevented invasion, eventually brought about, helped to bring about the end of the Cold War. We went from a situation in the Balkans in the 90s where the difficulty in NATO was to get to the decision to do something. Once we decided to act, military power was seen as very successful, very quickly. It brought the results in a way that was acceptable to public opinion and was seen as legitimate. And despite all of the problems in the Balkans, which I described, hesitation, contradictory policies, our stock rose. By 1999, our stock was very high. We were seen as the organisation that could act. Now, I also mentioned, however, a warning signal at the Kosovo campaign, which was, hey, wait a minute. You're spending billions and billions of dollars on all of this high-tech stuff, and you're firing all of these missiles. And yet, 78 days later, here's Milosevic, still defiant. He's only lost 14 tanks. Where's the evidence that you've actually had some impact on this particular conflict? Now, that was exaggerated because we know that Milosevic was about to give in. He obviously did not want a confrontation with NATO, particularly one which would involve the introduction of ground troops. But we've seen in Afghanistan a situation where the use of military power, albeit essential to stabilise the situation, isn't by itself able to achieve decisive effects. We've spoken about the comprehensive approach, the civilian surge, and all of those things. I believe that the worst thing that could happen to NATO would be a situation where our public opinion believe that the one thing that we can really do more than others is of less and less utility. So why send another division? What good's that going to do? You've got already hundreds of thousands of troops or whatever. It's not true. We've got about 70,000 troops all told. And you're not able, you know, to keep the Taliban at bay or the situation is getting worse. Now, I think that we will solve this in Afghanistan, and putting in more military power initially is going to be part of the effort. But the point I want to make is that we have to make certain in this alliance that we don't allow that asset to be devalued. That means we're going to have to continue to transform it so that it's able to have a bigger impact. We've talked about some of the things that we have to do. We've got to make it more culturally aware of how to operate successfully in environments with a different religion, different languages, different culture. We're going to have to enable that military power to work more effectively on reconstruction. We're going to have to also make sure that that military power interacts more and better with the civilian agencies. But I still believe that in the 21st century, NATO will continue to define itself as the organization which can best use military capability to solve international problems. And if through an absence of thinking about the lessons and making the tough choices to make sure that our military instruments are really adapted to those situations, if that's not done, and as I said, our military forces are seen as increasingly irrelevant to the solution of problems, NATO will be sidelined. That is, if you like, at the end, as any good historian would want to do, not to end on a note of triumphalism, but on a slightly more sobering warning note, that as much as it wishes to be a political organisation, as much as it wishes naturally to be an organisation with a world view, NATO should make sure at the end of the day that the one thing that it has which is unique is protected and maintained. So there I am. I've reached the end of the road. I haven't had the arrogance of the Spanish King Alfonso XIII, who once said, if God had had the good sense to let me design the universe rather than him, I would have done it much better. I haven't had that arrogance. I've tried not to prognosticate, but more to analyse what's gone from the past and where we are now with it in the future. I've also tried to outline some of the lessons. And if I am still alive, and I hope, of course, that NATO will still be alive in the 70th anniversary and invites me back to do another balance sheet, we will see to what degree I was right, or like many historians of the past, totally wrong. Thank you.
I would have a question about the Kosovo crisis. I was not so young at that period. I was 20 years old, I remember. It was my first entry into the real international life when looking at, watching at the Kosovo crisis and watching at you every day on television. I would have two questions. First, when the crisis began, the general belief in the public opinion, whether on the supporter's side or the opponent's side, was that the air campaign would last 3 or 4 days or a week. And I was wondering if this was also the belief inside NATO. And the second question is, after 1 or 2 months of campaign, to what extent was NATO considering a ground offensive?
Thanks for the question. The answer is yes. Nobody expected the air campaign to go on for 78 days. We didn't put a limit on it, but we'd seen in Bosnia that the use of force produced results rather quickly. It was really the political impact of force that we believed mattered, not the military effectiveness of force. There was even a theory going around in 1999, before Kosovo, that Milosevic, this may sound strange, but this is true, Milosevic wanted a NATO bombing campaign to give him an excuse to negotiate a climb down with the international community. The argument was, well, you know, as soon as NATO's bombing me, I could turn and say, oh, look, people, clearly you don't want a war against NATO, so we have to give in. That was a totally wrong analysis. I think that one of the problems here was that, as I've said in my lecture, much effort went into persuading allies to get to the moment where they were prepared, psychologically, politically, to start a conflict with Yugoslavia. The first time NATO had ever used force in a more offensive way. I don't mean that in an aggressive way, but offensive in the sense that we had set a number of conditions and then decided to initiate force ourselves. And that was difficult. We had the legal issue, as you remember. What's the legal basis? Is there a UN resolution? And because that consumed so much of our time and energy, we spent too little time thinking about, well, Milosevic, what guy is he? What sort of guy is he really like? Who is he? You know, what's he likely to do in responding? What countermeasures can he take? We didn't think about that at all. We were too optimistic that as soon as we said we're going to get tough, our adversary would immediately surrender. And we're discovering in Afghanistan that NATO's image or prestige by itself is not going to make adversaries fall down on their backs and say, we surrender. We're going to have to win against them militarily in the field. That was the first lesson, unfortunately, of Kosovo. Ground troops, yes. This was very difficult. The Americans wanted to avoid ground troops. Clinton had promised the American population that it would be short, that he would avoid casualties. His national security advisor, Sandy Berger, was telling him, Mr. President, you don't want any bodies coming back in any bags. In the Pentagon in particular, as we know from the book that Wes Clark, the Supreme Allied Commander, wrote, there was a sense that we don't want to use too many assets on Kosovo. You know, Kosovo is not sufficiently important for us to use ground troops, and you know, therefore let's just keep it with an air campaign. So for the Americans, it was very difficult. And Tony Blair, the British Prime Minister, went to America and worked very hard to convince the Clinton administration that they had to have an option to use ground troops because the air campaign might well not succeed, and then that would have to be done. And eventually, yes, the Americans did change their mind. I think they also realised, frankly, that by the autumn of 1999, if the war was still going on, NATO's credibility and their credibility, their credibility of leaders, would be so much at stake that even if they would have to have a very messy ground campaign, that they would have to do it. And I personally believe, Milosevic has not told me this, but I personally believe that it was the knowledge that there would be a ground campaign that made him eventually surrender. If we'd just said the air campaign will continue ad infinitum, I don't think Milosevic would have given in when he did.
How did NATO react on the fact that there was no UN mandate for the air campaign, and who were the strongest opponents against this air campaign in NATO?
Well, the legal basis was very important, and the Secretary General, as I mentioned at the time, Javier Solana, ensured that every ally had told him that, nationally speaking, in terms of their national constitutions, their parliamentary arrangements, they were satisfied that there was a legal basis. And if one ally had said, sorry, we don't see a legal basis for this, then the campaign could not have started. So this was very, very important. As I mentioned, we would have all preferred, really preferred, to have a UN resolution. But the problem we were confronted with is that it was clear that this could not be obtained in New York. And then we had the problem of being paralysed because of the absence of this resolution and seeing ethnic cleansing go on or taking action. The humanitarian crisis was key. For many countries, the fact that this was in order to stop a humanitarian disaster provided the legal basis. If there had not been that humanitarian crisis, I think it would have been much more difficult for many allies to have found an appropriate legal basis. But clearly it was difficult vis-a-vis public opinion. It was difficult in terms of taking the case to countries like India or China in the wider world. Naturally, we wanted to point out, as I said, that this was not a precedent for us. This was not going to, if you like, emancipate NATO to act in this way. And as soon as the air campaign finished, we immediately went to New York for 1244, that resolution, to put the deployment of the KFOR forces on a very firm legal basis indeed. So today it's still regarded as the exception rather than the rule. And I think, to be frank, we were encouraged. The fact that, for example, most countries in the UN supported us, Kofi Annan, the Secretary General, was very supportive too in his speeches. The Russians at one stage tried, once the campaign started, to pass a resolution in the Security Council condemning NATO. Only two other countries supported it, so it had to be withdrawn. You recall that before the end, Louise Arbour, the chief prosecutor of the International Tribunal of the UN, indicted Milosevic for war crimes in Kosovo, which also, I think, helped to give some legitimacy, additional legitimacy to the NATO action.
You mentioned earlier that this comprehensive approach was not invented, but like identified as an issue in 94 already. Strategic communication is also like a pending issue. We're still, I mean, this lecture series is also to tackle this issue. Issues are very important for an operation like in Afghanistan, and after 15 years now, we see NATO still struggling with those issues. So my question is, why is that? Or rather, is NATO perhaps not the right organization to deal with the operation like in Afghanistan?
No, well certainly, as I mentioned, NATO is the right organization, but it can't be the only organization. we've seen that in situations like Afghanistan, the percentage of the military capability versus the rest is lower than it has been in other conflicts, such as the Balkans, for example. I would say, you know, grosso modo, in the Balkans, you may have had sort of 50, 60%, 70% military force, 30% on the civilian side. But in Afghanistan, we've seen a reversal of that, where I would say 30% on the military side, 70% ultimately on the civilian side. Because the key thing, of course, is to get the support of the Afghan population by showing that the military presence leads to development and jobs and agriculture and all these kind of things. That said, if you took that 30% military away, you would have nothing, not 70%, but nothing, because the environment of security is obviously the key for that civilian development to take place. I think the problem is to some degree, in the 1990s, the Balkans were the main sort of scenario in terms of conflicts going on. There were other things, obviously, there always are in other parts of the world, but there was a very large media political concentration on the Balkans. And therefore, the Balkans were everybody's priority for the European Union, the United Nations. At one stage, for example, the UN had its biggest ever peacekeeping operation, UNPROFOR, 36,000 troops in Bosnia. So after the conflict ended, because those organisations had been heavily implicated during the war, they tended to stay for the peace. And so, as I said, when NATO went, I apologise, the partners were already there. I think the problem is Afghanistan occurred in the 2001, the 21st century, at a time when the Middle East was in turmoil, Darfur was happening, Somalia was happening, the Congo was in many respects imploding into civil war. We had a number of different issues around the world, and the UN had dispersed to some degree its resources into these other conflict scenarios. The EU was developing its common foreign security policy, essentially operations in Africa, in Chad, in Congo, as you know, in the Middle East, for example. And so the international organizations had developed sort of very different priorities. And persuading them that Afghanistan is a bigger priority than some of the others, particularly when they've already committed assets to those other regions, is not such an easy job to do. And that's one of the reasons why I mention all the time political leadership. The other part of your question relates to, yes, learning the lessons. It's true that we always talk about lessons learned, but as soon as the conflict is over, we tend to write them all up, put them on a dusty shelf somewhere, and forget about them, and then find that we're having to do everything and learn everything over again. That's true. But there are differences. As I mentioned, Afghanistan is a much longer operation. Kosovo was almost like a microsecond, even though it lasted 78 days, compared to the fact that, you know, Afghanistan has been going on since 2001. So you have to have a much more sustained effort over a much longer period of time. Also, essentially in Kosovo, we were talking to our own citizens, not to the rest of the world. We were trying to motivate Germans and Italians and Greeks and Americans to support NATO. But, of course, in Afghanistan, we're having to talk to a much more global audience, the Afghans themselves, Pakistan, Russia, the surrounding countries, to explain what we're doing. And, of course, that requires a much more elaborate effort with a much larger organisation. And, of course, very tight coordination between NATO headquarters and what our individual nations are telling their own populations. But, again, I think, just to ask one final question, I think that what we found in the Balkans is true of the future. Countries are normal, like human beings. A problem comes along. What do they want to do? They want the quickest, quick fix, cheap solution. Let's do it on the cheap. That's always we had that with Bosnia. Let's do it on the cheap. And you try that, and after a couple of years, think, this quick fix, let's do it on the cheap solution. What the British Defence Minister in Munich at the Munich Security Conference at the weekend said, you know, trying to fight wars on peacetime budgets. It doesn't work. I'm not suggesting a wartime budget, obviously not. But in the Balkans, the lesson that we learned was, sorry, you know, there is no quick fix. Let's do it on a cheap solution. You either do it properly or it doesn't get done at all. You've got to put the resources in commensurate with your strategy. It's no good having big ambitions and totally inadequate resources. And then, you know, as we say in English, the penny drops. There's this moment of awakening when suddenly you realize that, you know, you can't do it on the cheap anymore. You put the resources in and then things go better. I think we're arriving at that kind of moment now in 2009 that we arrived in Bosnia in 1995 and Kosovo in 1999.
Hello. So I'd say, first of all, thank you very much for the lecture series we've had. We've been looking at NATO's history and six major turning points in the last 60 years. And I'd like to ask you a question about NATO's future. Every campaign that NATO's led has been a test of NATO's credibility, its military ability to succeed in different environments. And for Afghanistan, it's certainly one of the hardest ones we've had so far. But what do you see as the implications of success in Afghanistan for NATO's future?
Well, I think that the implications of success will reverberate far beyond NATO, because if you have success in Afghanistan, I think dealing with the international problem of extremism and organized terrorism, possessing weapons of mass destruction, I think that problem will be much more manageable than if we allow, because we fail, Al-Qaeda to set up all kinds of training camps on the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan with millions of dollars and start organizing the kind of attacks we saw on 9/11. So it's not a question of the prestige of NATO. I generally believe that this is really about the future of the civilized world in not allowing this to happen. And maybe that's the message that we haven't so far succeeded as we should in getting across to our public opinion on that one. But certainly, if this goes right, there, I think, will be a much larger willingness of the allies to use NATO to address global challenges like proliferation, dealing with other failed states, for example, in particular developing the network of global partnerships. The trust among the allies will be good. And I think the fact that we did succeed in Afghanistan will mean that the problems will be less in future in a way, because I think we would have established clearly a sort of a new deterrence in terms of showing a readiness to respond against these kind of challenges, which I also think would have a much larger effect, including here in Europe, in terms of ensuring stability. The problem, as we know from the 1930s, is that if you fail to prevent a challenge to international order, if you're seen as on the sidelines, whether it be in Manchuria in 1931 or in Abyssinia in 1935 or in the Rhineland or in Prague in Rhineland 1936 or Prague 1938, you know, the message gets out that, you know, the democracies are weak and they're challengeable and we'll go from this to that. You know, dictators don't stop. They don't recognize finite limits, nor do people who want to do us harm. So my sense is that we've got to recognize that it's not just about Afghanistan and our security from one single organization, Al-Qaeda, there. It's part of a much larger sort of debate about what kind of values are going to rule in the 21st century. And that's why, despite all of the difficulties, I believe that the Allies, having tried initially to do it on the cheap and, you know, look for the quick-fix solution, will put the resources in that we need to be successful.
Good afternoon. If you are here in another 10 years, given your history and for the next anniversary, do you think that you might see NATO's response over Georgia as another turning point? And if so, where do you think this turning will lead us?
I'm very pleased, obviously, as a result of that, that NATO has not backed down or reversed its policy or decided that we're going to rethink the offer in Bucharest to Georgia and Ukraine to be members of NATO one day. That's for certain. But I think it's an also interesting case in how things are working in the 21st century, in the age of globalization, to those who sort of break the rules of international conduct. Because you've seen that, for example, those countries suddenly find that their stock markets plunge. the capital suddenly flees out of their borders because people are rather uncertain about things like transparency or stability and so on. And that, ironically, those that use force sometimes punish themselves as much as they punish others in the age of globalization. So, as far as NATO is concerned, the commitment that we have to the territorial integrity of every state, especially our partner states, is going to be upheld. Also, though, what I hope it's going to do is to convince Russia that although it may have felt obviously very strong in the wake of the energy price increases of a few years ago, because, as you know, Russia is a very large exporter of oil, natural gas, and therefore may feel that it can afford a totally different type of foreign policy. The reality of the credit crunch is we're all in the same boat, frankly. We need international cooperation to get out of that. And listening to Putin, President Putin, speaking at the World Economic Forum in Davos just a couple of days ago, there was a much more moderate message about Russia's position and international cooperation than we may have heard a while ago. And therefore, you know, things that at the time, and this has been one of the points of my lectures, that might come across as sort of major setbacks, like what happened in Georgia over the summer, can, you know, if statesmen are wise enough, be turned into opportunities that Russia recognises that it needs us as much as we need Russia, that this is not, you know, just a one-way, you know, we're stronger than they are, they need us more than we need us, that the Russia also suddenly find, you know, we've got problems of our own. You know, demographics, for example, in industrial decline, life expectancy, and so on. And, you know, we're going to need some international help with these kind of problems, particularly if we can't depend on oil and natural gas prices to solve those problems for us. We face proliferation around the world. We face terrorism. We face extremism. And so a rethink on their side in order to form the basis of a proper NATO-Russia dialogue. So, you know, the key thing of NATO's history is how we turn crises into opportunities, and that's exactly the same thing that we have to do now as well.
Jamie, can we thank you in the name of all the people who came in?
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your efforts, your patience, and your wonderful lecture.
Thank you, Luke. Thank you very much. Thank you.